Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Adam Campbell, a permaculture teacher who lives at the Stillwater Sanctuary and teaches at the Peace and Permaculture Center. This is the second of several episodes released from one long conversation I had with Adam. As this picks up right where things left off from the first show, it's best if you start there and then join us again here. You'll find a link to that first show in the show notes. In this case, we begin with him sharing a story about his friend Megan, who started her own personal honesty project, and what making a radical change in one's life is like. We also talk about having confidence and trusting yourself to do transformative work, and then move to more about thoughts on education and learning, inside and outside the traditional school system and halls of academia. I think this episode fits well with the previous interviews from Natasha Alvarez, Stephen Herod-Buhner, and of course Ethan Hughes. If you haven't heard those, I definitely recommend checking them out. Also, if you enjoy this conversation, or any of the others in the archive, make a donation to the show so it can continue to grow. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Adam Campbell. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates.
My friend Megan one time decided she wanted to start what was called the Honesty Project, and she decided she was tired of like being not duplicitous, but just, you know, small talk and engaging in like conversations that she wasn't really interested in, you know, or whatever. She only wanted to be doing things that were really bringing her vitality in life, and she only wanted to be fully honest with people. And not just like half honest, you know, but just like really just completely honest and not necessarily blunt, but just to be upfront and honest about what was going on in her life in that moment. And just like, for instance, be like, you know, I'm not actually really very interested in this conversation right now. But also not to say, screw you, this is boring. You know, to be able to, like, convey that with, you know, compassion and meaning and just see where it goes. And what she realized is that she ended up pissing off about 90% of the people in her life, and she lost a lot of her relationships. But what she found is that the relationships that did stay ended up being much more valuable and tighter to her than the other ones were, and she brought new people into her life by the new authenticity she was modeling that were much better, I mean, for her, than she had been with before. So there is this devastation of taking on this new way of being. And I think people look at that and they get really afraid because they realize if I make some sort of change in my life, whether that's an emotional change or whether that's some sort of physically based change, like I'm going to cut out blank, that there's this fear that their life is going to change and their relationships will be altered in some way. Well, they're right. Their assessment is correct. Those things will happen. And there is a kind of a dark night of the soul when that devastation does happen. But what they don't see, what's almost impossible to see until you've had experience of it, is that there's another side to that devastation and dark night of the soul, and that's the phoenix. There's a rebirth that always comes from the ashes if you can stick to it. And that rebirth is a rebirth of who you are based on the core things that can't be burned away, the truth that's a part of you that comes out once all the crap is gone, you know, and that, when it's given us more of a strength to speak in the world, will attract the things that that thing wants, and you'll find your relationships and your life much more coherent, strong, vital, and healthy.
Your background in English and literature really comes through with some of the idioms that you're using and the way that you're bringing this together in a way that's articulate and poetic in ways that my kind of a blunt analytical side is not. So, man, thank you for that.
Sure.
We sat down to talk about permaculture and education, and in many ways we're talking about the problems of some of the hierarchical pieces and what people need to discover within their own selves in order to be, as Stephen Herod-Buhner would put it, the citizen scientists, to find our own calling and to bring these different pieces together. Be authentic to ourselves. If the formal academic world works for you, then that's great. But here we are working on other models for people that if that's not the place that they come from, then don't go there. Find what works for you. For me, as we're talking about communication, I think that's one of the pieces that, you know, definitely learn about nonviolent communication and some of these other ideas so that you have different tools in your toolbox to communicate better. But when we talk about communication, that doesn't have to mean face-to-face. If you are someone who is not good at that kind of extroverted, I'll sit down and talk with anybody, find the ways that you communicate, that it doesn't have to be with spoken words. It could be through the written word or art or something else so that you can share and express yourself with other people and that they can share and express in their own way in return.
Right. I mean, you bring up a pain for me, like just in that I see in the world that I just want to address, which is, you know, if people like the world the way that it is, or if they're able to enter the system and the way that it is to be able to do what they want to do in a way that they feel like it's meaningful and responding to the problems that they see in the world, then that's great. But what I see a lot of times is people who are trying to force themselves into the system, and the best way they can kind of figure out to kind of try and make it work in some sort of way where they kind of felt met, you know, and those are the people that I want to say, don't try. Try something different, which is find ways of accessing what's most alive in your soul, and then find the way to work the courage muscle, to flex the courage muscle, and to enter into the world of the unknown. Joseph Campbell talks about this archetype all the time with the journey of the hero. You know, he says to follow your bliss, you know, or follow your nose is another way that I've put it. But the thing that's hard about that is that to follow your bliss, there's always, Joseph Campbell talks about, there's always a threshold. And the threshold is between the world of the known and the world of the unknown. And to make that jump, no matter who you are, no matter what it looks like for you, it's always scary. But it becomes less scary the more that you get experience with it and the more that you can practice that courage. And so that, I feel like, again, if we're talking about education, this needs to be part of our education. I mean, I want to see what that looks like, and we're working on it right now. Like, how do you help people train to enter into the unknown with not just patience, but also like confidence, even bravado, you know, but not over the top, you know, of course, because there's a great mystery that we're working within, you know, that we need to be led by, but we also have, you know, agency within too. That is what I want to say to people who are trying to make it work and it just doesn't feel like it's clicking, which is that there is another way. And that way is what's called the margins, you know, and this is one of the permaculture principles, is the value of the margins and the edge effect. You know, that's where life is the richest, because there's so many ecotones meeting at the same time. That happens within ourselves, too. If we're able to opt out of the system and to find the place where we're most alive, that's where all of our internal ecotones are meeting at the same time, and we hit the sweet spot. But, unfortunately, that sweet spot almost always comes up against the inertia of our system. And so you need community. That's where the network comes in. And that's what the value of this podcast and this conversation is like helping to establish a network of people who are part of Paul Hawkins' Blessed Unrest, that we're all kind of out there, but the media doesn't care about us. You know, like it's hard to kind of find necessarily where we're at, but we're doing the work and we're doing it with love and we're giving it as a gift because it's our life's passion. And that we can support each other in doing this work because, as Gandhi said, we need a million experience in nonviolence. So let's help support each other in doing that by like living into our life's call.
There are two pieces that I was thinking through that after losing my narrative thread by what you just said as I come back to it. Two pieces that I keep coming back to about education and people being able to find that right livelihood. I don't think a lot of people are able to love themselves or trust themselves in some ways in order to feel comfortable by making those decisions. It's been ground out of them, or when they try to make those decisions, the people who they call friends or family fight against them for it. And this idea that, you know, especially within society, well, how do you make a living? Well, the only way that you can make a living is with money. And people don't have models to show them otherwise, or that they can live differently and still be okay.
Yeah.
And it's something Ethan spoke to about, you know, people look at it and they go, oh, well, I can't live without this and I can't live without that. And it's like, well, give it up. And see what it's like. I don't think if you give it up, your life is going to fall apart, because we're adaptive. We'll find different ways to make it through.
Yeah. I mean, we live in the era of insanity and of agonizing choices. It's so difficult sometimes to be able to access what's alive in you and then find a safe place to share that. Because my experience has been that when an authentic voice comes up inside of me, it starts very quietly. And so first of all, we have to find time and space in our lives to allow that nuanced silence to be able to begin to express itself in a way that can be heard by our conscious mind. That's the first thing that needs to happen. That's not easy, especially in our culture, which is rapaciously trying to take any kind of free time we have. Then the next thing that you need to do, once you can actually begin to in some way embody or articulate what's happening to you, whether that's through some new decision that you want to make even though you don't know why, or whether it's a new idea in your head that you want to start talking about, however it occurs to you, you have to find a safe place to share that. Because my experience, this has happened to me several times, is that if you don't have that period of gestation, it's a very fragile thing, and it can be squashed by people with the best intentions. There's a story for me that I came back from my backpacking trip around the world, and I had this intuition that I wanted to exist differently in the world, but I didn't know what that meant yet. And I returned home to be with my parents before I took off into the world again. And the first thing I realized is that there was kind of an atom-shaped hole waiting for me to come back into. And that atom-shaped hole had all kinds of expectations and habits and patterns. I didn't quite fit that hole anymore, but the longer that I stayed there, the more I started to conform to that hole, to the old way of being. And I needed to kind of like find a new canvas to kind of express these new ways of being, which I didn't know what they were yet. They hadn't really actually taken shape yet. And kind of the moment that happened for me, which really articulated this, was I kind of felt like I didn't want a car anymore. I'd had a car that had been handed down to me for a little while, and I was kind of feeling like I didn't really want it anymore. And I ended up, for whatever reason, however the magical mystery tour that we're on works, I ended up falling asleep at the wheel and totaling it. I definitely did not do that on purpose. But all of a sudden, I was in a car, and I had this insurance payment come to me, and I was like, oh, great, you know, now I can maybe go travel or figure out something else to do. And my dad, being of the highest intentionality, was like, oh, well, you know, I'll help you go out and find a used car so you can replace the ones you got. And I was like, well, and this is the first time I'd ever said anything like this. And I was like, well, maybe I don't want to get a car. You know, maybe I'll try something different, like ride my bike or something. And then both my parents go, oh, of course you want a car. And I was like, oh, you're right, of course I want a car. And that was it. And then a week later, we were out at the used car lot, and we ended up getting almost exactly the same car that I had just totaled. And it was just that easy because I trusted my parents so much, you know, because they'd been such good, powerful forces in my life. But what I realized later on, looking back at that experience, was that the people who are closest to us are the ones that we need to be the most careful with about sharing things. We have to know who are going to be, Ethan calls them possibility cheerleaders, I call them community of support and accountability. You have to find the people who are going to support you and your vision and help you be accountable to what you're saying, not yes people. They're people who are going to listen to what you're saying and really help you suss out what's alive in you and not give you their own opinion, you know, but just to feedback what they're hearing so you can begin to actually try and make it manifest. And then when you can articulate it in a way that feels a little bit more confident to you, they're going to support you in doing it. Even if they don't know what to do, they'll be like, I'm going to find somebody who can help you do this. You know, and don't get me wrong, my parents are on my community of support and accountability. It's just that I had to learn how to communicate with them ideas that were still gestating in me. And sometimes that means not sharing things at a certain time, but sharing with them later. That discernment is key. You know, like when do you share these new things that are gestating inside of you so that you can begin to create a path for you that's authentic? And then how do you find the courage to actually bring that into the world when you know that you're going to meet resistance as you begin to bring that in by relationships that are formed by an old way of being? And sometimes that resistance is very small and minor and very easy to engage. And sometimes it's very extreme and takes all of your capacity to be able to say, no, this is who I am. This is my authentic calling. This is my vocation in the world, and I have to choose this. And I want to make this work with our relationship, but this has to happen. And hopefully there's a creative third way where all of our needs can be met.
One of the things that I talked about before we began this conversation, and some of the things from the story that you just shared with me, is that I come from a bit of a darker place, if you will. And this kind of, in some ways, talks to nonviolent communication and some of the ideas from the Four Agreements and these other pieces in order to build those kinds of relationships. And to give some background and context to that, with that story that I was sharing with my family earlier, and what you were saying about Dominic Barter and his presence, one of the things that I think about for education and life is that, from my background, it was that idea of, because my father was raised to be a tradesman and swing a hammer and do this other work, even though that's not what he wound up doing for a living, the idea was instilled in me that I would go off and be an academic and get a white-collar job that would be a whole bunch of money, and I would never need anybody else because that money would allow me to pay for whatever I need.
Yes, I know the story well.
I talk about one of the references that I make, and I don't know if this has the same cultural experience for you, but given our similar ages, or at least I think we're of similar age based on some of the stories that you've shared with me so far, is my dad was kind of like the Fight Club dad. There's a piece from the movie, if you've ever seen it.
Yes.
Where the narrator and Tyler Durden are sitting, and I forget which one is in the bathtub, and it's that whole thing about, well, I talked to my father about what I'm going to do next. Well, I graduated high school. What do? I don't know. Go to college. Get a degree. Well, now I have a degree. What do? I don't know. Get a job. You know, well, what next? I don't know. Get a wife. Buy a house. Have kids. And it's like this wash, rinse, repeat thing.
Yeah.
And that story that we're told, you know, of having a job to make money to buy things that we don't need to impress people we don't like, or something to that effect. Even though I think my position is more mature at this point, that was very influential in my thought process of making that break. But it was strange for me to do that, because when I came home to be a stay-at-home dad, I joke with one of my buddies for how long we've known each other, but it's been over 5 years now since I made that choice. But when my wife and I made that decision, the pushback that we had from our family to do that, because the focus was all on income and money, what are you going to do without your income? How are you going to make that work? What's going to happen? It's like, well, we don't know, but we think it'll work, and we're just going to see what happens. And even then, as I was talking about, you know, well, I'm going to go become a teacher. Oh, well, you did IT. You had all this money. Why don't you go back and do that? Well, I don't want to do that. And from there, it was, I had another family member as I was talking about a lot of this stuff. And the phrase that kept coming up was, well, you're not good enough. How are you going to do that? You're not good enough to do that. You don't have the skills to do that. You know, it was very cutting. And then, as you say, about knowing when you're going to share things with people and having that right group of people around you as part of your community, I realized that I needed to step away from that relationship. And then it was also with some friends and other people, there was that feeling that we were like crabs in a barrel, because as one person would try to climb out and have success, it shone a light in some ways on the places where they weren't having success, and it became kind of negative and toxic and dragging people down. And it's spending the last couple of years building a group of friends that's supportive, because we're all trying to, in many ways, continually improve ourselves and grow. Even though we may not all be on the same path, it's this group of people who care enough about the others to help them grow. And there's that. And I also kind of have a group of people who believe in the work that I'm doing, and I believe in them and their paths, that are separate from this other supportive group. And we've kind of become each other's brain trust that we go to. And it's kind of funny, because I'm a teacher. One is a Lutheran seminarian who's on his path to become a minister. He just became a vicar. As he's working through school. And then another one is a maker and a craftsman. And the three of us kind of come together and have conversations about like green technology and building a different world within our own specialty. And it's interesting to bring that together. Where I'm going with this is that within the story that I was told, within the story of society that goes back to Dominic embodying a lot of this, is that I think in order to share these ideas well with others and to build these models, that whatever path we're on, we have to embody it so that people can look at us. And even if they might not understand it, that in some way they see that expression or feel that expression of authenticity within our presence. When you were talking about information earlier, I think it's real easy to get information because there's tons of it. The numbers I forget was that up until like 2008 or something like that, humanity had created a certain amount of knowledge measurable in bits and bytes of data. And I'll see if I can find the numbers and put them in the show notes. But up until that point, humanity had only built so much information. And we'll just call that one for sake of this conversation.
Up until what year?
Up until like 2008 or 2006, 8 or 10 or something like that. I don't remember the exact number, but it's within the last 10 years.
Okay.
That all of human history leads up to one amount of information.
Okay.
But that we're now doubling that exponentially. And it's to the point it went from like all of human history to just a couple of years. And I think we now may even be down to months of information that we're generating. But I don't know that that information is knowledge without that embodied experience.
It's not.
My dad didn't teach me to swing a hammer because I was going to pay somebody else to do it. But now that I'm trying to gain those skills, as you say about reading the landscape, without the experience, you might be able to go out there and go, okay, well, you've got these trees that are growing here. This one's allelopathic. This one does this. Let me go back and put something together based on that. That's completely different from when you're out there experiencing these different things and you're seeing these plants growing together naturally in guilds. And you go, oh, well, the black walnut's allelopathic, but here's a hackberry growing right next to it.
Right. And a pawpaw and a persimmon and all different kinds of things that aren't affected by it.
Right. And that goes back to that the very beginning, that sense of place and being rooted in an area and in a community to see that. And that experience comes together and you walk onto a landscape and you can build and put things together in different ways that don't connect the dots in the same way that just having information is. That you build this body of knowledge both within yourself from experience and this information that you gain. And then you're able to impart it in others via wisdom. a description I've heard before, is that wisdom is being able to learn from other people's mistakes, and that that becomes in some ways a teaching moment as you're sharing with others as all these pieces come together. And the way that I think of the permaculture hierarchy, that we have the techniques is on the ground, and then some strategies above that, then we have the principles and the ethics are at the very top, that for education, our experience is that top, it's that ethic, it's this holistic piece of ourselves that allows us to divvy up the other parts as we actually go and do the work. Standing there with my father when we're changing out studs in a wall, and he's tearing out the drywall with me, and he's looking at it, and he goes, okay, over here's some discoloration. That's probably from water damage, because there's probably a leak somewhere that's dripped here and caused this issue. So now we're going to have to go find that. Oh, okay, if we're going to replace these, oh, well, we can't cut these out. We're going to have to put something in beside it and bolt them together, but this other piece we can cut out. But when we cut that out, we're going to have to go to the other side of the wall and nail that back in to support the drywall that's there. And like guiding me through this entire process, that reading a book doesn't teach me. Learning how to just put up drywall doesn't put these other pieces together. I think that for me, that's where education requires experience, to bring it together so that we can be authentic in the work that we're doing. Anyway, there's a long-winded little piece for me how this connects and resonates with these pieces that you've been sharing for this kind of like final picture of someone in building a right livelihood and authentic education.
Yeah, and of course, that brings up a lot for me what you just said. The two things that pop up to the top of my queue from listening to that, first, responding to what you just said, you said experience. And I think the fundamental thing of a proper education is based on experience and relationships. Those are the things that are the substance of our lives, not anything else. And there's a great misnomer going about right now that knowledge is increasing. And by implication, our human goodness is increasing as well, and I completely disagree with that. Information is increasing. Well, I should say information of a certain kind, and I spoke to this earlier. A certain kind of information is increasing. But I would feel like that our actual wisdom is decreasing, because we're growing a great fetish around this idea of disembodied information being valuable, kind of a great competition to see who can collect the most information, even though it's not being applied and it's not being put in context to anything that's relevant. And then there's another kind of information that's being lost that can't be conveyed through written words or through screens. And I would say that that is more in the realm of experience and wisdom coming from relationship and intuition. And, you know, Joel Salatin has said that we've gotten really good at hitting the wrong bullseye. And so more education of the same kind is only going to get us better at hitting the wrong bullseye. So people who say, well, something's wrong, so we need more education, is an absolutely incorrect statement and a part of the insanity of our world. We need education of a different sort. Education is important, but not the kind that we have right now, at least not a lot of it that we have right now. And David Orr has also gone on to say that we are becoming more ignorant of the things that we need to know to how to live well and sustainably on the earth. A certain kind of information is increasing, and at the same time, we are becoming more ignorant of the things that we must know to live well and sustainably on the earth. Both of those things are happening at the same time. And so I have a great fear of the fetishization of the information accumulation that we have going on, because information that's free of context is trivia and dangerous. And then the other thing that I wanted to point out to what you said, which is so easily missed, especially for a conversation between two analytical folks like ourselves. You began that story by talking about a really significant and perhaps severe conflict between your hope for your life and your family's hope for your life, based on your family's experience and what they hoped for you out of love and care, and then what you hope for yourself out of your own love and care for yourself, and that there was a conflict there. There was actually a different approach to the strategy that would work well for you. But there wasn't a difference in some of the fundamental needs that were there. Some of the fundamental needs there were for you to be safe, for you to be quote-unquote successful, and by that I mean to be able to meet your human needs in a way that worked well for you and for your family, and for you to be happy. And what I want to say about that is we're all experiencing some degree of that in this culture today, in the first world, quote-unquote first world. We've all been born into a culture that we didn't create and that we didn't have a hand in forming, but is fundamentally disturbed and is also disintegrating. And there's a great grief that comes with that, and we can't overlook that. it's going to affect each one of us in a different way, and it's going to cause struggles for all of us in a very particular way that's ours and ours alone, but can also be shared with other people who are experiencing something similar. That same kind of desolation or dark night of the soul, the same kind of struggle, the same kind of difficulty of being able to access what's alive inside of us, the same kind of fear of what might happen if we were to actually speak what was really on our hearts or in our minds, the same kind of trepidation of taking that first step down the path that is yours and yours alone, and the fundamental unsurety or uncertainty that it actually is going to lead in a direction that's going to give you what you want, given that the path already laid out in front of you by society will meet half of your needs anyway. You know that if you get a job and make money, you will be able to consume things that will keep you alive. That's guaranteed. But the other path has no guarantees, but there's the hope that all of your needs will be met. The need for fundamental human expression, for creativity, for livelihood, for joy and robustness, for authentic relationships with the earth and with each other, for the subtlety and nuance of the beauty that comes out when a conversation changes from, you know, superficiality to substance and you realize, wow, something's happening here that's really exciting. These are the things that keep us alive, and they can't be quantified, and they can't be turned into information that can be put on a screen or in a book. And these are the things that feed us. Our soul needs sustenance too, not just our bodies. And we've been born into a system that doesn't do that. And the reason why I'm pointing that out is to let us know that we all have a shared experience to some regard in that kind of grief, and that we can come together and grieve together, and that's what we need to do. We just need to take some time and recognize and get out of our heads and realize the sadness there. Like, there's a fundamental sadness and grief that's a part of this. That, wow, by the best of my intentionality, by me wanting to be a good person in the world, I was laying waste to so many cultures and civilizations that I will never meet, or affecting people somewhere that are mining stuff that I needed to buy my whatever. Like, I've affected their lives in a way that most likely was not good, and the land that they're living on. And I was doing it out of trying to be a good person. And this is a totally, it's crazy. Like, what do we do with that situation? I think my response to what we do in that situation is we just allow ourselves to feel first and to not skip it. My analytical Western male approach is, well, let's fix the problem. And I've had to learn not to skip the emotional reality of the fact that this is a little messed up. And it's sad. And I need to take some time to process that and to go through it. Because my joy for the world is also my sadness for the world. And if I don't honor both of those, then I'm not honoring the authentic experience of myself. And if I can't honor that authentic experience, then I won't actually know how to take authentic action in the world. So I think it's really easy for the two of us to be talking about education and right livelihood and being left-brainers to skip the emotional reality of the fact that we're in a culture of some level of desolation, we need to be able to grieve to be able to move into the world. And I also, at the end of that, want to say that I've painted a kind of a stark picture of reality, and there's a divine paradox happening in our lives all the time, and that is that creation is wondrous and amazing and beautiful. And there's always moments of great joy and beauty around us all the time. And I'm not a depressed person, you know, as I speak this way. I'm just trying to be honest about what my experience is, and that my experience has both of these happening at the same time, and I want to honor both of them and not privilege one over the other. I want to say, wow, I'm alive today, and isn't that a miracle? It is a miracle. I mean, Wendell Berry said that we are holy creatures living amongst other holy creatures in a world that's holy, you know, and this, what a big deal is it a miracle to turn water into wine when sunlight with soil and water turns water into grapes? Or that was kind of a misquote, but that's one of my favorite quotes by Wendell Berry. So I just want to hold those two things together and to not miss the fact that what you're telling is a shared experience of all of us, and that there's grief involved there, and I want to be able to honor that.
And I think that in many ways the conversation that we've had about our own lives and some of the things that have led us to where we are speak to both that joy and that sadness. And the long road that it's taken to find where we are and be able to live authentically in our own ways. We sit here telling stories and sharing, but the way that all of that speaks to the importance of education and finding what matters for ourselves, and that leads to different paths. And I'm wondering if you can speak to me some more about what you're looking at for your model at the Peace and Permaculture Center for the education that you're going to be doing there.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. You know, the first thing that comes to mind as we transition from kind of talking about education in general to kind of specifically what we might be doing here is Mark Twain's quote of, like, I never let my schooling get in the way of my education. And, you know, there's this amazing kind of equation in our culture, which is people think that their education happens in a school. And they go to school to get an education. And then when they graduate, they're done with their education, and then they can get on with the rest of their lives. And that kind of compartmentalization and fragmentation is so easy in our culture because all of our culture is compartmentalized and fragmentized. You know, like one of the messages I got going to church was that we go to church to be holy from 10:30 to 12 on Sunday and maybe on Wednesday night sometimes if we want to. And then the rest of our lives is just the rest of our lives, you know, and maybe try to put in some of the Bible in there sometimes if you can figure out how to do it. And I see this sometimes in the permaculture world too. It's like, well, you know, I'm living my life the way I do it, but I've got this really great permaculture garden where I've got like some fruit trees and some swales. And I think this is complete misread, if not a blasphemy, of those three things that we're talking about. One would be sacredness, you know, and however you manifest sacredness in your life. And to think that sacredness only happens in a building at an hour and a half at a certain day of the week is blasphemy. And I would say that thinking that your education only happens when you're in a school, which again, as I said earlier, is usually surrounded by drywall and tile and some sort of chalkboard or dryboard, you know, and like some person up in the front who is deemed an expert who's disseminating information in a way that you're supposed to fill up your brain and then go use it somehow or not use it at all because it's just valuable just by the person speaking. That is totally, it's inhuman. It's literally, if I could use that phrase, it's inhuman. To be human is to be led by curiosity into the wonder of the world and to create a dialogue and dialectic with it and to be changed by it. It's not just like taking notes and then taking a test. It's such a, there's not even a word for how crass that is. And I'm an English major. There's just not a word there for how much is lost in that. You know, you talked about earlier about your parents telling you, well, you get a job to make money, and then you make money so you can get the things that you need. And Lewis Mumford called that horn of plenty, like, of the unlimited goods or the unlimited ability to consume that the tech society promises. He called that a magnificent bribe meant to get us to overlook what's been lost in the bargain. You know, it's a magnificent bribe. Oh, I can unlimitedly consume anything that I might need. But imagine what's lost in the process. It's all of the unquantifiables that we've been talking about in this conversation that are the real substance of our lives. And it's the same thing when it comes to permaculture. You know, how many people have I met who are like, oh, I have a little permaculture garden. Like, isn't this cute? Page one, okay, of the designer's manual is one of the most radical documents I have ever read. And I've been in radical circles for a little while. It's amazing. Like he says, a person of courage today is a person of peace. The courage we need is to refuse authority and to accept only personally responsible decisions. We must withhold all support for destructive systems. He's saying this on page one of the designer's manual. You know, and then like you go on a few more pages and he talks about, you know, uses of resources, right? And he says, sane societies will preface like the top three versions that it gives, which, you know, are resources that increase with use or like stay the same with use or aren't affected by use. And then the category five on his list of resources is resources that pollute other resources when you use them, which are the vast majority of the resources that we use in our culture. And he says sane societies ban the use of those. Not only that, page one of the designer's manual, the prime directive of permaculture is the only ethical decision is to take personal responsibility for yourself and your family and to do it now. Take personal responsibility for yourself and your family and to do it now. Can you just imagine what that would actually look like if you took that seriously and not just thought that was some sort of cute thing that like, oh yeah, I'm responsible for myself because I speak honestly and I compost. You know, what he's talking about is a complete revolution in every single aspect of our lives. David Holmgren said the process for providing for people's needs within ecological limits requires a cultural revolution. He didn't say the process for providing for people's needs within ecological limits requires swales and some earthworks, you know, and an understanding of the mineral cycles. He said it requires a cultural revolution. And I don't disagree, because if you think about what does it mean to take personal responsibility for your life, for your family, and by that I mean to be fully accountable for it, to be the primary cause of it, to be the primary cause and be fully responsible and accountable for your food, for your shelter, for your clothing, for your relationships, for your personal integrity and for the integrity of your community, for the flow of your water, for your waste. These are our fundamental human needs. And if we're really going to think about, wow, to be fully accountable and to be the primary cause of all these things in my life would require an almost entire dismissal of the American way of life and a recreation of something new. My favorite article is Wendell Berry's Think Little. And in Think Little, Wendell Berry says, if we're going to take this seriously, we need to rebuild private life in this culture because it's been completely externalized to experts, to corporations, to bureaus, to the government. We've externalized responsibility for all of it. We don't know how to do any of it anymore. And he calls this madness mass-produced. It's my favorite indictment of this culture of all time. It's lacerating. It's just unbelievable, like, what he's able to say. If I can remember it, he says, a man who understands the weather only in terms of golf, I think he says, is participating in a chronic public insanity that he will or his descendants will be bound to realize is suffering. Chronic public insanity is what we're a part of. And not only that, but then he goes on to say that he believes that the death of this world is breeding in those minds, which are our minds, much more certainly and much faster than any political capital or atomic arsenal. These are incredible indictments of our culture. And if we look about how our lives are often like laid out, they're completely fragmented and compartmentalized, and we can begin to think, and I'll speak for myself here, I can begin to think that like, oh, well, I can do permaculture here, and then I can be sacred or holy here, and then I get my education here, and that's going to work out fine. I feel like that goes against the very essence of what sacredness is in our lives. My experience of living here, and then going out into the modern world, and then coming back again, and then going out again, is that the modern world is so fragmented and so time scarce, and it's in such time poverty, the people that I run into, that I feel like literally, I don't mean this metaphorically, I mean I experience them as their souls are splintered, and that they can't carry a sense of peace with them because they feel like there's so much they need to do and fit into their days. But a cultural revolution would look totally different from that. A cultural revolution would be led with a unified force. You would stack so many functions with the one action that you're doing that you would be meeting most, if not all, of your human needs by just one or two or three actions in a given day that wasn't split up into all these different like things that you need to do, which as we return to the land find is entirely possible, or as Peter Morin called it, the land and craft-based society, to begin to take responsibility for those things and to get our hands in the soil again, we've realized we're doing many things at the same time. You know, by taking responsibility for my own food, I'm also taking responsibility for my own health, and I'm active again, so I don't need to go to the gym anymore because I'm getting plenty of exercise out here. I don't need to find time to go outside because I'm already outside anyway. I don't need to find time to go have dinner or date with friends because I'm working with friends. And it's all happening with just one focused action. I'm just getting up and doing the work that needs to be done for the day to take care of myself and my community. And it's all right there. And I feel like this is what education begins to look like. It's not schooling necessarily, hopefully not for very long at all. A typical model in American society is that we go to school, or schooling lasts for about 17 years, roughly, so to speak, I think, if that's right, from about 5 to 21 or 22. And these days, it's becoming expected that if you're going to be quote-unquote successful, then you're going to at least go to grad school, if not a doctorate degree. So that's getting up to 20 to 25 years of schooling, and then your education's done, right? I imagine a schooling which is much reduced from that, to just get basic skills to engage with the world and with each other, and then be led by our curiosity and experience, perhaps by a mentor, into the world, and then let our path unfold as only our path can. That cannot be led by a syllabus, but it's only led by a dialogue with the mystery of things.
And that was the second of the series with Adam Campbell. I have another 2 hours of raw audio from the day that he and I spoke, so I'm expecting there will be another 2 releases from my time spent talking with him. Something I want to speak to from this conversation comes from near the beginning, when Adam and I were talking about making new models that work for ourselves and others, and about giving up things to find what we do and don't need. One of my fellow students from the martial arts class that I take, when he and I were working through some material, he kept reminding me, make it smaller, make it smaller. Keep making it smaller until it doesn't work, then make it a little bit bigger until it does again. And that's how I've come to think about making these kinds of changes in our lives. I'm not a jump in with both feet kind of person. So I look at removing a little piece and then another little piece and another little piece until I get to a place where something doesn't work. And then when it's not right, add a little bit back until it does work again. Just to kind of experiment until I find that, well, as Goldilocks had with the three bears, something that's just right. And I find that through that experience, you discover what your tolerances are. What does too much of something mean? What does too little mean? And what actually really works for you as a person? What do you really need? What are you capable of? And from there, and in order to get to that point, to learn those things, you took action. And I find those kinds of actions that lead to success being what's necessary to find the confidence to do bigger things. But as always, the first place you start is in designing a plan and then taking action. What are your thoughts after hearing this conversation with Adam? I'd love to hear from you. Email show@thepermaculturepodcast.com or call 717-827-6266. You can also join in the conversation by liking the show on Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or follow me on Twitter where I am @permaculturecst. Coming up next week is Wilson Alvarez and Ben Wise, and we'll be talking more about rewilding and their rewilding school. I'll be going to visit them and Natasha at the end of February, so if you have more questions about rewilding or tending the wild, Zone 4 permaculture, or permaculture's revolution, send me an email or give me a call. The week after that, on February 25th, is Kelly Ware to continue the series on faith and earth care as we talk about the intersection of Christianity and permaculture. One last note is that I'll be attending a gathering of farmers, an event that's going to be held on March 8th, 2014, and organized by Certified Naturally Grown. This event is going to be on the grounds of Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. If you're in the area and would like to attend, perhaps we can take a few minutes to meet and catch up. You'll find a link to that event in the show notes. That's going to wrap this one, everybody. Thank you for joining me again. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And that little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under Creative Commons, Attribution, No Derivatives, Non-Commercial License. Feel free to share it with whoever you like. Just tell them where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.